This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Global politics overshadowed the markets today and moved them as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, January 3rd. Good to have you with us. The world is holding its breath to see how Iran will retaliate for the U.S. killing of a powerful military leader. Many are also nervously watching the oil market, in which Iran holds a critical place. The world economy still runs on crude oil, so analysts are trying to assess the heightened threat to oil fields, oil workers, pipelines and processing facilities, tankers and shipping lanes. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Washington on what this might mean for oil prices.
Sarah Vakshuri at SVB Energy International thinks Iran's reprisals will begin in Iraq.
Because Iran does not want to enter into a direct war with the rest of the world.
Iraq has oil fields and facilities run by American companies. And like the U.S. embassy, they appear to be taking precautions with their employees.
We have heard through our network that, yes, some of the U.S. companies have already started calling their staff out.
Vakshuri says Iran is unpredictable where it attacks and when, so it will be a guessing game. Matt Smith, who tracks oil vessels at the firm Clipper Data, says Iran is known for seizing tankers and hitting them with mines. He's watching the Iraqi port of Basra.
Iraq is one of the leading oil exporters in the world. They send out of Basra 3 million barrels a day. Perhaps attention will shift towards Iraq and the potential disruption in flows there.
Many analysts predict that these kind of land and sea attacks could boost oil prices by $10 a barrel, or about 15%. Already, prices for oil tanker trips have spiked from $115,000 to $300,000, says James Jang, head of maritime at Aegis Capital. He says already many vessels are avoiding the region.
The chatter right now is rates are being pushed up just because of limited supply of vessels in the region because of possible war risk.
But the big risk is an escalating incident that leads to all-out war, says Ilan Goldenberg. He's former Iran chief at the Pentagon, now at the Center for New American Security. If a crisis spirals, he says Tehran could close the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil flows.
Anything that might trigger that all-out confrontation between the U.S. and Iran is actually the thing that is likely to have long-term impact on global oil supply and global oil price.
Some analysts say that scenario could cause oil prices to double. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And with that, we turn to the first weekly wrap of the new year. And for that, I'm joined live in the studio by Anna Swanson of the New York Times. Hey, Anna.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to kick off the decade with you here.
I mean, I'd say happy New Year, but it's a little bit of an awkward day. Scott just laid out the stakes in terms of this escalation with Iran, although the Trump administration is arguing it's a de-escalation. How did the markets take all this today?
So we did see a strong reaction. Markets fell. Prices of gold rose as a safe haven for investors in terms of turmoil. And oil prices also soared, of course, over concerns that instability in the Middle East could disrupt that industry. If the United States can avoid more conflict, I think we'll likely see the markets shake this off pretty quickly. But the effect on oil prices could be longer lived. And you did have some Fed officials today talking about conflict in the Middle East as a recession risk as well.
Okay, we're going to talk more about the Fed in a minute, but it got a little bit buried in all of this Middle East news today. There were some pretty grim manufacturing numbers out this morning. U.S. factory orders had their worst performance in more than a decade. Those numbers from the Institute of Supply Management. What's going on there?
That's right. So this index of manufacturing activity continued to contract and showed this very low reading, which suggests that a global manufacturing recession isn't quite behind us yet. And although the United States and China have announced an initial trade deal, they haven't totally been able to shake off the pain of the trade war. And that's in part because this deal that the United States and China have announced actually leaves the bulk of the tariffs that the U.S. put on intact. So there's still much higher prices for American manufacturing. And this index today suggests that the effect of higher prices is continuing to weigh on that sector.
Now, things have been slowing down in this sector for a while now, as you mentioned, because of the trade war. At what point does this start to be a problem for the broader economy outside of manufacturing?
Well, thankfully, consumer spending continues to be strong in the United States, and that's what really drives the bulk of our economy. But it's definitely a worrying sign for the economy that manufacturing is slowing. It looks like in large part due to the trade war, but there's also been the effect of a stronger U.S. dollar and slower global growth overall. And this is really an engine for the U.S. economy and one that could also leave a political cost in terms of potentially President Trump's legacy here.
And it's also one of these indicators the Fed is watching. And we got some news from the Fed. Their minutes from the last Fed meeting were out today. And at that meeting, the Fed governors decided to hold rates steady. So are there any extra insights in this summary of what was discussed?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the Fed feels like it's in a very good place after three rate cuts in 2019. And that's exactly what the minutes show today. Their forecast for 2020 looks pretty boring. You know, they're likely to be on hold. The Fed's goal is to be about as exciting as watching paint dry. Overall, it does look like the case for further cuts is probably better than the case for further hikes. The Fed is still concerned about inflation being under their 2% target. And of course, there are new worries today about the turmoil in the Middle East and whether that could lead to more of a recession risk.
Right. Very quickly, you were saying phrases like boring and watching paint dry up until today. How closely is the Fed watching what's happening between Iran and the U.S.?
Well, there were some remarks today. Thomas Barkin, the head of the Richmond Fed, described this conflict in the Middle East as a recession risk. And then in an interview with my colleague today, Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan was talking about the price effect, saying that the spike in oil prices had actually been muted by the growth of the fracking industry in the United States and U.S. energy production. So if we do see a price, you know, further price spikes as a result of turmoil here, that will hurt American consumers, but actually it could end up benefiting some American energy producers that are producing more natural gas now.
Anna Swanson of The New York Times, thank you.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, all that news Scott and Anna were just talking about did a job on the markets today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now we're going to turn to something a bit lighter because today we certainly need it. The gaming industry is starting off the new year strong, both in terms of revenue and audience size. Global spending on video games, which includes digital games for mobile devices, computers, and gaming consoles, hit a new high last year, $120 billion in sales. And as Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports, the industry is looking for new ways to make money off its growing audience.
Video game industry revenues were up 3% last year, says Joost van Drunen. He helped compile the numbers at the Nielsen firm Superdata.
Over the last year, a large part of the growth comes from new players entering the market. The overall pie is growing.
Some game publishers now have an audience base of hundreds of millions. A lot of that growth is coming from mobile devices, which account for more than half of game revenues. Ian Bogost is professor of interactive computing at Georgia Tech.
The vast majority of those games are games that are free to download and usually free to play.
Game makers make money by getting a small slice of their audience to pay for upgrades, like buying special game tools, fancy costumes, upgraded weapons, or more opportunities to play. And the size of that business? last year's top-grossing video game, Fortnite, made $1.8 billion. And that's from paid extras.
Even the people who created Fortnite were surprised by the scale of the success.
Mike Fisher is a video game industry executive who worked on Fortnite for a time. He says the game showed how financially successful it can be to get lots of people playing together, even for free. He says the next big thing this year will be subscription gaming. Pay a monthly fee to play available games as much as you want.
That's going to really shake up the games business, similar to how Netflix has changed Hollywood and how Spotify has changed the music industry.
Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Sony have come out with subscription services. And Superdata predicts more advertising will target all those eyeballs in free games. I'm Novosoff for Marketplace.
Lots of people use online gaming as a way to meet and stay in touch with friends. Because, let's be honest, making and keeping new friends as an adult can be tough. According to a 2018 survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 2 in 10 Americans report they often or always feel lonely. But where there's a will, there's often a business willing to find a way. Lisa Bonos covers relationships and dating for The Washington Post and recently reported on this burgeoning industry. Lisa, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So why is it so hard to make friends as an adult?
There are so many reasons. People's lives just get busier. You know, once you're out of college and you don't have that consistency of seeing people all the time in classes or activities, and everybody becomes busier with work and family obligations, it becomes harder to have like lasting relationships.
You point out in your article about this that there's a growing number of paid services that appeal to people who want to make friends.
Yeah, there's a whole like friendship making business out there. Dating apps have different modes in their apps specifically for making friends. Like Bumble has a BFF mode.
Best friend forever.
Yes. Even co-working spaces, sort of as they're hawking a desk, they're also trying to sell a sense of community. And there's a local matchmaker in Washington, D.C. who you can literally pay to set you up on friend dates.
This was interesting. This is a woman who works professionally as a romantic relationship matchmaker, and she's now expanding her business to setting up friendships.
That's correct. She was really finding that people were lonely and they wanted friends. And she's finding this among 20-somethings all the way up to 70s and 80s, like empty nesters whose kids have left home and also their friends have also left the area. This woman, Michelle Jacoby, charges $700 or upwards to set people up on friend dates. And so I went along as two women went on a ropes course for an afternoon. And I waited there as one of them was 30 minutes late to show up, which just kind of highlights the fact that you can set two people up that have a lot in common. But friendship is also built on consistency and showing up for one another, right? So that is maybe not a great first impression. They have hung out other times since then, and I think they are genuinely friends. But it takes time to solidify a bond like that.
So if apps are expanding into this business and individual matchmakers are working on this, there's clearly some sort of business opportunity that people see here. Any sense of what the market is for dropping $700 or whatever a monthly fee on an app is to make new friends?
It's hard to assess. You know, Michelle is working with people who have a lot of money to throw around for that, right? I think it does show that friendship is something that people value and would pay for help in that area. And it also kind of validates the fact that it's hard. You know, I also spoke to a woman who is a therapist who runs friendship making workshops. And also she spoke to the fact that the skills that are involved in making new friends, we don't actually really teach that.
In a way, a lot of people do want to blame tech for their social woes, remote work, that it's a product of our digital economy. So should digital solutions like apps be part of the solution as well?
I think they can be. But, you know, what was so interesting is one woman that I spoke to out in California who did a lot of work to create new friendship circles. She did it the old-fashioned way. She put up posters in her local coffee shop saying,
"That's the old-fashioned way."
Well, she wasn't going online looking for friends, right? And she actually created this group where she planned different kinds of events, like not just a book club where everybody would have to be readers, but they did things like maybe they read a book together, but then another time they went shopping. And after about a year or so of planning these monthly events, she now has a group of friends in her hometown.
Lisa Bonos covers relationships for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
And we thought that was ridiculous. We thought there's no way we could do that.
Raising $1 million to fix up a local ski trail. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 233 points, 0.8%, to close at 28,634. The NASDAQ lost 71 points, 0.7%, to finish at 9020. And the S&P 500 was off 23 points, 0.7% as well, to end at 3234. As we heard from Scott Tong, uncertainty in the oil markets today. ExxonMobil sputtered 0.8%. Chevron slipped down 0.3%. Tesla's revving on reports it delivered 112,000 vehicles this quarter, more than analysts anticipated. Tesla was up 2.9%, but General Motors sales were down in a quarter that included a month-long strike. GM declined 2.8%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.79%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hello to 2020 and all the new Marketplace investors who joined us before the end of the decade. Thank you so much for being part of this community of donors who believe in the importance of trustworthy, independent news and information. It's your ongoing support that keeps us going strong and helps make people smarter everywhere. Thanks again and Happy New Year.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. It's been just over 2 years since President Trump signed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Despite claims from the administration that it would pay for itself, it hasn't. Corporate tax revenues fell by 40% between 2017 and 2018. And even in the last few months, some companies continue to lower their tax bills thanks to a swarm of lobbyists. Jesse Drucker covers taxes for The New York Times and wrote about how this is playing out. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the tax overhaul passed in 2017. Big win for a lot of companies in that there's a lower corporate tax rate. Those big negotiations in Congress are over, but you're reporting on the negotiations that are still happening. What's going on?
Yeah, well, so whenever Congress passes a new law, particularly when it passes a complicated tax law, it then goes to the Treasury Department, which then has the job of writing regulations to help figure out how to administer the new law.
And how is that process playing out with the tax law?
Well, one of the issues here is that the 2017 law, between the time of the introduction and the time of the signing, was literally 7 weeks. There wasn't a single hearing on the bills or on the new law. And so it was an extremely quickly and sloppily written and kind of poorly thought out law, which is kind of incredible also because it was basically the biggest change to the federal income tax code in 100 years. The result is that Treasury had a kind of much tougher job than usual, and in some ways was given much more power than usual because there were so many kind of holes and gaps in the new law.
You focus on, in particular, how multinational firms have been lobbying for changes. What are they lobbying for and what did they get?
So the law had sort of a carrot and stick approach in some ways to big companies. It lowered the corporate rate pretty dramatically from 35% to 21%. And it also gave companies a pretty big tax break on the trillions of dollars that they had stashed overseas in tax havens like Bermuda and the Cayman Islands. But in exchange for that, it also introduced two new measures to try to discourage companies from pushing profits into tax havens. And those two measures were projected to raise about $260 billion over the coming decade. And companies lobbied Treasury to figure out how to get out of those new measures, and in many cases, they were successful.
Growing up, my dad had this little knickknack on his desk that said, "Everybody wants a tax shelter with a loophole in it." And I mean, how surprising is any of this? Everybody, companies and individuals, everybody wants to pay the least amount of tax as possible. So how surprising is it that these big companies with all this lobbying money at their disposal would do something like this?
It's not surprising that companies would lobby to try to affect the regulations process here. What probably is surprising is the degree to which they were successful and to the degree to which things that are simply not spelled out in the law were granted to them in the regulatory process. Another issue here is that the whole process is basically from one side. In other words, there's no kind of Greenpeace for tax justice. The Treasury Department's not hearing from anyone on the other side. They are only hearing from multinational companies. And I interviewed many tax attorneys who said, they said, "I just don't see how the Treasury Department could do anything else. I mean, it's only natural. If 99.9% of what you're hearing is from one side, you're more likely to go in that direction."
What are the implications of all of this?
Well, I mean, the most obvious implication is that the government is going to collect a lot less revenue than it was projected to collect. I mean, the two new taxes that are now being undermined by the Treasury Department would be enough to fund basically the EPA and the National Cancer Institute and the Treasury Department, you know, combined for a decade. So if you're undermining those taxes, they're clearly going to collect less money. And so it means there's less money to spend. So that, you know, there's two things that can lead to. Either you cut government spending or you run a higher deficit. But it's pretty straightforward kind of what it leads to.
Jesse Drucker covers taxes for The New York Times. Jesse, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
As Jesse was just saying, federal, state, and local governments rely on tax revenues to pay for things like road construction, the main emphasis there being on roads and bridges for cars and trucks. But now some cities are also investing more heavily in trails, partly for health and recreation and general community pleasantness, but also because they can draw tourists and have other economic benefits. In many places, trail construction and maintenance would not be possible without very passionate volunteers. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker has more.
Hello, Duluth. How are we doing today? Last month, Olympic cross-country skiing gold medalist Keegan Randall paid a visit to Duluth, Minnesota.
You guys ready to do some sprint racing?
Randall led a pack of young skiers up and down hills and zipping around tight corners on a new trail at the base of a downhill ski area. She was there to generate excitement and money for the Duluth Cross Country Ski Club, which is raising money to finish the trail.
It's like seeing the thing we thought was not possible actually in real life.
Annalisa Peterson is a past president of the club. Northern Minnesota has seen inconsistent snowfall lately. So nearly a decade ago, the club approached the city about building a trail with artificial snow. But the electrical and plumbing infrastructure is expensive. So the city challenged the club to raise $250,000 to help pay for it.
And we thought that was ridiculous. We thought there's no way we could do that. And in part, it was a philosophical shift. It was like the club had never done anything like that.
But it worked. Last year, the trail's first phase opened. The cost to finish the project, though, has grown. So Peterson says the club has upped its game.
I think we had to get over our Minnesota nice a little bit. None of us are comfortable asking the people that we know for money and repeatedly, that's me again, care to donate.
They've now raised nearly $1 million, about a quarter of the trail's cost. A similar story has played out around Duluth, where clubs have raised money to build biking and horseback riding trails, even an ice climbing park. Around the country, more volunteer organizations are helping to boost recreation infrastructure.
It certainly gets the attention of local leaders when the small nonprofits come to the table with some skin in the game.
That's International Mountain Biking Association Director Dave Weens. He says local fundraising has helped build extensive trail systems from Alabama to Nevada. Weens says increasingly cities are approaching mountain bikers about building trails to promote tourism or as a way to help local employers attract and retain talent.
In other words, it's not just the mountain bikers anymore that are looking for the trails or the trail users. It's, you know, municipal leaders who may not ride a mountain bike at all, but who are connecting the dots between what trails can bring a community.
Count former Duluth Mayor Don Ness as one of those politicians who chooses not to whip down a twisty trail on a mountain bike. But after the 2008 recession, when a local club approached him with a vision to build a single-track trail across the city, he loved the idea, with one caveat.
It has to be driven by the people who are most passionate about it, allow them to take ownership of it.
So he told them, you're going to have to raise money. It costs about $45,000 to build 1 mile of trail.
You're going to need to find the volunteers to maintain these and demonstrate that you have a community of support that is large enough and vital enough and active enough to support this long term.
Since then, the group has raised more than $1 million to build nearly 90 miles of bike trails. That success laid the groundwork for the cross-country ski trail and several other projects. The city is contributing $18 million from a sales tax on hotels and restaurants. And of course, the outdoor recreation amenities not only draw tourists, they're nice for residents, too. In Duluth, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, we were talking earlier with Lisa Bonos about using online services to make new friends in this cold and lonely world. Well, if you're looking for more than a friend, this weekend is your time to shine. According to several online dating sites and apps who obviously have a financial incentive to promote this idea, Sunday is the busiest day for swipes and likes all year. They've branded the first Sunday in January Dating Sunday. Sites are predicting double-digit increases in active users on their platforms, probably people coming back from holidays spent with ever-so-helpful friends and family, wondering and asking out loud that age-old question, why are you still single? We've got to go. Today, the Dow fell 233 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq lost 71 points, 0.7%. And the S&P 500 was down 23 points, 0.7% as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you Monday.
This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.